crawling. I followed. He moved surprisingly fast on all fours, and I had quite a job to keep up with him. Every few seconds, he would glance back at me to see if I was all right, and each time he did so, I gave him a nod and a smile. We crawled on, and then at last we were kneeling safely behind a big clump of bushes right on the edge of the clearing. My father was nudging me with his elbow and pointing through the branches at the pheasants. The place was absolutely stiff with them. There must have been at least 200 huge birds strutting around among the tree stumps. "You see what I mean?" he whispered. It was a fantastic sight, a poacher's dream come true. And how close they were! Some of them were not 10 paces from where we knelt. The hens were plump and creamy brown. They were so fat, their breast feathers almost brushed the ground as they walked. The cocks were slim and elegant, with long tails and brilliant red patches round the eyes, like scarlet spectacles. I glanced at my father. His face was transfixed in ecstasy. The mouth was slightly open, and the eyes were sparkling bright as they stared at the pheasants. "There's a keeper," he said softly. I froze. At first, I didn't even dare to look. "Over there," my father whispered. I mustn't move, I told myself. Not even my head. "Look carefully," my father whispered. "Over the other side, by that big tree." Slowly, I swiveled my eyeballs in the direction he indicated. Then I saw him. "Dad," I whispered. "Don't move now, Danny. Stay well down." "Yes, but Dad, it's all right. He can't see us." We crouched close to the ground, watching the keeper. He was a smallish man with a cap on his head and a big double-barreled shotgun under his arm. He never moved. He was like a little post standing there. "Should we go?" I whispered. The keeper's face was shadowed by the peak of his cap, but it seemed to me he was looking straight at us. "Should we go, Dad?" "Hush," my father said. Slowly, never taking his eyes from the keeper, he reached into his pocket and brought out a single raisin. He placed it in the palm of his right hand, and then quickly, with a little flick of the wrist, he threw the raisin high into the air. I watched it as it went sailing over the bushes, and I saw it land within a yard of 2 hen birds standing beside an old tree stump. Both birds turned their heads sharply at the drop of the raisin. Then one of them hopped over and made a quick peck at the ground, and that must have been it. I looked at the keeper. He hadn't moved. I could feel a trickle of cold sweat running down one side of my forehead and across my cheek. I didn't dare lift a hand to wipe it away. My father threw a second raisin into the clearing, then a third, and a fourth, and a fifth. It takes guts to do that, I thought. Terrific guts. If I'd been alone, I would never have stayed there for 1 second. But my father was in a sort of poacher's trance. For him, this was it. This was the moment of danger, the biggest thrill of all. He kept on throwing the raisins into the clearing, swiftly, silently, one at a time. Flick went his wrist, and up went the raisin, high over the bushes, to land among the pheasants. Then, all at once, I saw the keeper turn away his head to inspect the wood behind him. My father saw it too. Quick as a flash, he pulled the bag of raisins out of his pocket and tipped the whole lot into the palm of his right hand. "Dad," I whispered, "don't!" With a great sweep of the arm, he flung the entire handful way over the bushes into the clearing. They fell with a soft little patter, like raindrops on dry leaves, and every single pheasant in the place must have heard them fall. There was a flurry of wings and a rush to find the treasure. The keeper's head flicked round as though there were a spring inside his neck. The birds were all pecking away madly at the raisins. The keeper took two quick paces forward, and for a moment I thought he was going in to investigate. But then he stopped, and his face came up, and his eyes began travelling slowly round the edge of the clearing.
"Lie down flat," my father whispered. "Stay there. Don't move an inch."
I flattened my body against the ground and pressed one side of my face into the brown leaves. The soil below the leaves had a queer, pungent smell, like beer. Out of one eye, I saw my father raise his head just a tiny bit to watch the keeper. He kept watching him.
"Don't you love this?" he whispered to me.
I didn't dare answer him. We lay there for what seemed like 100 years. At last, I heard my father whisper,
"Panic's over. Follow me, Danny, but be extra careful. He's still there. And keep down low all the time."
He started crawling away quickly on his hands and knees. I went after him. I kept thinking of the keeper who was somewhere behind us. I was very conscious of that keeper, and I was also very conscious of my own backside and how it was sticking up in the air for all to see. I could understand now why poacher's bottom was a fairly common complaint in this business. We went along on our hands and knees for about 100 yards.
"Now run," my father said.
We got to our feet and ran, and a few minutes later we came out through the hedge into the lovely open safety of the cart track.
"It went marvelously,"
my father said, breathing heavily.
"Didn't it go absolutely marvelously?"
His face was scarlet and glowing with triumph.
"Did the keeper see us?" I asked.
"Not on your life," he said. "And in a few minutes, the sun will be going down, and the birds will all be flying up to roost, and that keeper will be sloping off home to his supper. Then, all we've got to do is go back in again and help ourselves. We'll be picking them up off the ground like pebbles." He sat down on the grassy bank below the hedge. I sat down close to him. He put an arm round my shoulders and gave me a hug.
"You did well, Danny," he said.
"I'm right proud of you." Chapter 15. The Keeper. We sat on the grassy bank below the hedge, waiting for darkness to fall. The sun had set now, and the sky was a pale smoke blue, faintly glazed with yellow. In the wood behind us, the shadows and the spaces in between the trees were turning from grey to black.
"You could offer me anywhere in the world at this moment," my father said, "and I wouldn't go."
His whole face was glowing with happiness.
"We did it, Danny," he said, laying a hand gently on my knee. "We pulled it off. Doesn't that make you feel good?"
"Terrific," I said. "But it was a bit scary while it lasted."
"Ah, but that's what poaching's all about," he said. "It scares the pants off us. That's why we love it.
Look, there's a hawk."
I looked where he was pointing and saw a kestrel hawk hovering superbly in the darkening sky above the ploughed field across the track.
"It's his last chance for supper tonight," my father said. "He'll be lucky if he sees anything now."
Except for the swift fluttering of its wings, the hawk remained absolutely motionless in the sky. It seemed to be suspended by some invisible thread, like a toy bird hanging from the ceiling. Then, suddenly, it folded its wings and plummeted towards the earth at an incredible speed. This was a sight that always thrilled me.
"What do you think he saw, Dad?"
"A young rabbit, perhaps," my father said, "or a vole or a field mouse. None of them has a chance when there's a kestrel overhead."
We waited to see if the hawk would fly up again. He didn't, which meant he had caught his prey and was eating it on the ground.
"How long does a sleeping pill take to work?" I asked.
"I don't know the answer to that one," my father said. "I imagine it's about half an hour.
It might be different with pheasants, though, Dad.
It might, he said. We've got to wait a while anyway, to give the keepers time to go home. They'll be off as soon as it gets dark. I've brought an apple for each of us, he added, fishing into one of his pockets.
A Cox's orange pippin, I said, smiling.
Thank you very much.
We sat there munching away.
One of the nice things about a Cox's orange pippin, my father said, is that the pips rattle when it's ripe. Shake it, and you can hear them rattling.
I shook my half-eaten apple. The pips rattled.
Look out, he whispered sharply. There's someone coming. The man had appeared suddenly and silently out of the dusk, and was quite close before my father saw him. It's another keeper, he whispered. Just sit tight and don't say a word.
We both watched the keeper as he came down the track towards us. He had a shotgun under his arm, and there was a black Labrador walking at his heel. He stopped when he was a few paces away, and the dog stopped with him and stayed behind him, watching us through the keeper's legs.
Good evening, my father said, nice and friendly.
This one was a tall, bony man with a hard eye and a hard cheek and hard, dangerous hands.
I know you, he said, coming closer. I know the both of you.
My father didn't answer this.
You're from the filling station, right?
His lips were thin and dry with some sort of a brownish crust over them.
You're from the filling station, and that's your boy, and you live in that filthy old caravan, right?
What are we playing, my father said. 20 questions.
The keeper spat out a big gob of spit, and I saw it go sailing through the air and land with a plop on a patch of dry dust 6 inches from my father's plaster foot. It looked like a little baby oyster lying there.
Beat it, the man said. Go on. Get out.
When he spoke, his upper lip lifted above the gum, and I could see a row of small discolored teeth. One of them was black. The others were brownish yellow, like the seeds of a pomegranate.
This happens to be a public footpath, my father said. Kindly do not molest us.
The keeper shifted the gun from his left arm to his right.
You're loitering, he said, with intent to commit a nuisance. I could run you in for that.
No, you couldn't, my father said.
All this made me rather nervous.
I see you broke your foot, the keeper said. You didn't by any chance fall into a hole in the ground, did you?
It's been a nice walk, Danny, my father said, putting a hand on my knee. But it's time we went home for our supper.
He stood up, and so did I. We wandered off down the track the way we had come, leaving the keeper standing there, and soon he was out of sight in the half-darkness behind us.
That's the head keeper, my father said. His name is Rabbits.
Do we have to go home, Dad?
Home? My father cried. My dear boy, we're just beginning. Come in here.
There was a gate on our right leading into a field, and we climbed over it and sat down behind the hedge.
Mr. Rabbits is also due for his supper, my father said. You mustn't worry about him.
We sat quietly behind the hedge, waiting for the keeper to walk past us on his way home. A few stars were showing, and a bright three-quarter moon was coming up over the hills behind us in the east.
We have to be careful of that dog, my father said.
When they come by, hold your breath and don't move a muscle.
Won't the dog smell us out anyway? I asked.
No, my father said. There's no wind to carry the scent.
Look out. Here they come. Don't move. The keeper came loping softly down the track, with the dog padding quick and soft-footed at his heel. I took a deep breath and held it as they went by. When they were some distance away, my father stood up and said,
It's all clear.
He won't be coming back tonight.
Are you sure?
I'm positive, Danny.
What about the other one? The one in the clearing?
He'll be gone too.
Mightn't one of them be waiting for us at the bottom of the track? I asked. By the gap in the hedge.
There wouldn't be any point in him doing that, my father said. There's at least 20 different ways of reaching the road when you come out of Hazel's Wood. Mr. Rabbit knows that. We stayed behind the hedge for a few minutes more, just to be on the safe side.
Isn't it a marvellous thought, though, Danny, my father said,
that there's about 200 pheasants at this very moment roosting up in those trees, and already they're beginning to feel groggy. Soon they'll be falling out of the branches like raindrops.
The three-quarter moon was well above the hills now, and the sky was filled with stars as we climbed back over the gate and began walking up the track towards the wood.
Chapter 16. The Champion of the World. It was not as dark as I had expected it to be inside the wood this time. Little glints and glimmers from the brilliant moon outside shone through the leaves and gave the place a cold, eerie look. I brought a light for each of us, my father said. We're going to need it later on. He handed me one of those small pocket torches, shaped like a fountain pen. I switched mine on. It threw a long, narrow beam of surprising brightness, and when I moved it around, it was like waving a very long white wand among the trees. I switched it off. We started walking back towards the clearing, where the pheasants had eaten the raisins. "This," my father said, "will be the first time in the history of the world that anyone has even tried to poach roosting pheasants. Isn't it marvellous, though, to be able to walk around without worrying about keepers?"
"You don't think Mr. Rabbits might have sneaked back again just to make sure?"
"Never," my father said. "He's gone home to his supper."
I couldn't help thinking that if I had been Mr. Rabbits, and if I had seen two suspicious-looking characters lurking just outside my precious pheasant wood, I certainly would not have gone home to my supper. My father must have sensed my fears, because once again he reached out and took my hand in his, folding his long, warm fingers around mine. Hand in hand, we threaded our way through the trees towards the clearing. In a few minutes, we were there.
"Here's where we threw the raisins," my father said.
I peered through the bushes. The clearing lay pale and milky in the moonlight. "What do we do next?" I asked.
"We stay here and wait," my father said.
I could just make out his face under the peak of his cap, the lips pale, the cheeks flushed, the eyes shining bright.
"Are they all roosting, Dad?"
"Yes, they're all around us. They don't go far."
"Could I see them if I shone my light up into the branches?"
"No," he said. "They go up pretty high, and they hide in among the leaves."
We stood waiting for something to happen.
Nothing happened. It was very quiet there in the wood.
"Danny," my father said.
"Yes, Dad?"
"I've been wondering how a bird manages to keep its balance sitting on a branch when it's asleep."
"I don't know," I said. "Why?"
"It's very peculiar," he said.
"What's peculiar?"
"It's peculiar that a bird doesn't topple off its perch as soon as it goes to sleep. After all, if we were sitting on a branch, and we went to sleep, we would fall off at once, wouldn't we?"
"Birds have claws and long toes, Dad. I expect they hold on with those."
"I know that, Danny. But I still don't understand why the toes keep gripping the perch once the bird is asleep. Surely everything goes limp when you fall asleep."
I waited for him to go on.
"I was just thinking," he said, "that if a bird can keep its balance when it's asleep, then surely there isn't any reason why the pills should make it fall down."
"It's doped," I said. "Surely it will fall down if it's doped."
But isn't that simply a deeper sort of sleep? He said. Why should we expect it to fall down just because it's in a deeper sleep? There was a gloomy silence. I should have tested it with roosters, my father added. Suddenly, the blood seemed to have drained right out of his cheeks. His face was so pale, I thought he might be going to faint. My dad would have tested it with roosters before he did anything else, he said. At that moment, there came a soft thump from the wood behind us.
What was that? I asked.
Shh! We stood listening. Thump.
There's another, I said.
It was a deep, muffled sound, as though a bag of sand had been dropped to the ground.
Thump. They're pheasants, I cried. Wait. They must be pheasants, Dad.
Thump. Thump. You may be right, Danny. We switched on our torches and ran towards the sounds.
Where were they? My father said. Over here, Dad. Two of them were over here.
I thought they were this way. Keep looking. They can't be far. We searched for about a minute.
Here's one,
my father called. When I got to him, he was holding a magnificent cockbird in both hands. We examined it closely with our torches. It's doped to high heaven, my father said. It won't wake up for a week. Thump.
There's another, I cried.
Thump, thump.
Two more,
my father yelled. Thump, 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 thump.
Jeepers,
my father said. Thump, 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 thump. All around us, the pheasants were starting to rain down out of the trees. We began rushing round madly in the dark, sweeping the ground with our torches.
Thump, thump, thump.
This lot fell almost on top of me. I was right under the tree as they came down, and I found all three of them immediately, two cocks and a hen. They were limp and warm, the feathers wonderfully soft in the hand.
Where shall I put them, Dad?
I called out.
Lay them here, Danny. Just pile them up here, where it's light.
My father was standing on the edge of the clearing, with the moonlight streaming down all over him, and a great bunch of pheasants in each hand. His face was bright, his eyes big and bright and wonderful, and he was staring around him like a child who has just discovered that the whole world is made of chocolate.
Thump, thump, thump. It's too many, I said.
It's beautiful, he cried. He dumped the birds he was carrying and ran off to look for more.
Thump, 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 thump.
It was easy to find them now. There were one or two lying under every tree. I quickly collected six more, three in each hand, and ran back and dumped them with the others. Then six more after that. And still they kept falling. My father was in a whirl of excitement now, dashing about like a mad ghost under the trees. I could see the beam of his torch waving round in the dark, and every time he found a bird, he gave a little yelp of triumph.
Thump. Thump, thump.
Hey, Danny, he shouted.
Yes, I'm over here. What is it, Dad?
What do you think the great Mr. Victor Hazel would say if he could see this?
Don't talk about it, I said.
For 3 or 4 minutes, the pheasants kept on falling. Then suddenly they stopped.
Keep searching, my father shouted. There's plenty more on the ground. Dad, I said, don't you think we ought to get out while the going's good?
Never, he shouted. Not on your life. We went on searching. Between us, we looked under every tree within 100 yards of the clearing, north, south, east, and west, and I think we found most of them in the end. At the collecting point, there was a pile of pheasants as big as a bonfire.
It's a miracle,
my father was saying. It's an absolute miracle. He was staring at them in a kind of trance.
Shouldn't we just take about 6 each and get out quick? I said.
I would like to count them, Danny.
Dad, not now.
I must count them.
Can't we do that later?
1, 2, 3, 4. He began counting them very carefully, picking up each bird in turn and laying it carefully to one side. The moon was directly overhead now, and the whole clearing was brilliantly lit up. I felt as though I was standing in the glare of powerful headlamps. 117, 118, 119, 120, he cried.
It's an all-time record!
He looked happier than I'd ever seen him in his life. The most my dad ever got was 15, and he was drunk for a week afterwards, he said. But this, my dear boy, is an all-time world record.
I expect it is, I said.
And you did it, Danny. The whole thing was your idea in the first place.
I didn't do it, Dad.
Oh, yes, you did. And you know what that makes you, my dear boy? It makes you the champion of the world. He pulled up his sweater and unwound the two big cotton sacks from round his belly. Here's yours, he said, handing one of them to me. Fill it up quick. The light of the moon was so strong, I could read the print across the front of the sack. J.W. Crump, it said. Keston Flour Mills, London, SW17.
You don't think that keeper with the brown teeth is watching us this very moment from behind a tree, I said.
No chance, my father said. If he's anywhere, he'll be down at the filling station, waiting to catch us coming home with the loot.
We started loading the pheasants into the sacks. They were soft and floppy-necked, and the skin underneath the feathers was still warm. We can't possibly carry this lot all the way home, I said.
Of course not. There'll be a taxi waiting for us on the track outside the wood.
A taxi? I said.
My dad always made use of a taxi on a big job, he said.
Why a taxi, for heaven's sake?
It's more secret, Danny. Nobody knows who's inside a taxi, except the driver.
Which driver?
I asked. Charlie Kinch. He's only too glad to oblige.
Does he know about poaching, too?
Old Charlie Kinch? Of course he does. He's poached more pheasants in his time than we've sold gallons of petrol.
We finished loading the sacks, and my father humped his onto his shoulders. I couldn't do that with mine. It was just too heavy for me.
Drag it, my father said. Just drag it along the ground. My sack had 60 birds inside it, and it weighed a ton. But it slid quite easily over the dry leaves, with me walking backwards and pulling it with both hands. We came to the edge of the wood and peered through the hedge onto the track. My father said, "Charlie boy," very softly, and the old man behind the wheel of the taxi poked his head out into the moonlight and gave us a sly, toothless grin. We slid through the hedge, dragging the sacks after us along the ground.
"Hello, hello, hello," Charlie Kinch said. "What's all this, then?"
Chapter 17. The Taxi. 2 minutes later, we were safely inside the taxi and cruising slowly down the bumpy track towards the road. My father was bursting with pride and excitement. He kept leaning forward and tapping Charlie Kinch on the shoulder and saying, "How about it, Charlie? How about this for a haul?" And Charlie kept glancing back, pop-eyed, at the huge bulging sacks.
"Cripes, man," he kept saying. "How did you do it?"
"Danny did it," my father said proudly. "My son Danny is the champion of the world." Then Charlie said,
"I reckon pheasants is going to be a bit scarce up at Mr. Victor Hazel's opening day shoot tomorrow, eh, Willem?"
"I imagine they are, Charlie," my father said.
"I imagine they are." "All those fancy folk," old Charlie said, "driving in from miles around in their big shiny cars, and there won't be a blinking bird anywhere for them to shoot."
Charlie Kinch started chuckling and chortling so much, he nearly drove off the track.
"Dad," I said, "what on earth are you going to do with all these pheasants?"
"Share them out among our friends," my father said. "There's a dozen of them for Charlie here to start with. All right, Charlie."
"That suits me," Charlie said.
"Then there'll be a dozen for Doc Spencer, and another dozen for Enoch Samways."
"You don't mean Sergeant Samways," I gasped.
"Of course," my father said. "Enoch Samways is one of my very oldest friends."
"Enoch's a good boy," Charlie Kinch said. "He's a lovely lad."
Sergeant Enoch Samways, as I knew very well, was the village policeman. He was a huge, plump man with a bristly black moustache, and he strode up and down our high street with the proud and measured tread of a man who knows he is in charge. The silver buttons on his uniform sparkled like diamonds, and the mere sight of him frightened me so much, I used to cross over to the other side of the street whenever he approached. "Enoch Samways likes a piece of roasted pheasant as much as the next man," my father said.
"I reckon he knows a thing or two about catching them as well," Charlie Kinch said.
I was astounded, but I was also rather pleased, because now that I knew the great Sergeant Samways was human like the rest of us, perhaps I wouldn't be so scared of him in future.
"Are you going to share them out tonight, Dad?" I asked.
"Not tonight, Danny, no. You must always walk home empty-handed after a poaching trip. You can never be sure Mr. Rabbit or one of his gang isn't waiting for you by the front door to see if you're carrying anything."
"Ah, but he's a crafty one, that Mr. Rabbit's is," Charlie Kinch said. "The best thing is to pour a pound of sugar in the petrol tank of his car when he ain't looking. Then he can't ever come snooping round your house later on. We always made sure to give the keepers a little sugar in their tanks before we went out on a poach. I'm surprised you didn't bother to do that, Willem, especially on a big job like this one."
"What does the sugar do?" I asked.
"Blimey, it gums up the whole ruddy works," Charlie Kinch said. "You've got to take the entire engine to pieces before it'll go again after it's had the sugar. Ain't that right, Willem?"
"That's quite right, Charlie," my father said. We came off the bumpy track onto the main road, and Charlie Kinch got the old taxi into top gear and headed for the village.
"Are you dumping these birds at Mrs. Clipstone's place tonight?" he asked.
"Yes," my father told him. "Drive straight to Mrs. Clipstone's."
"Why Mrs. Clipstone's?" I asked. "What's she got to do with it?"
"Mrs. Clipstone delivers everyone's pheasants," my father said. "Haven't I told you that?"
"No, Dad, you haven't," I said, aghast.
I was now more stunned than ever. Mrs. Grace Clipstone was the wife of the Reverend Lionel Clipstone, the local vicar. "Always choose a respectable woman to deliver your pheasants," my father announced. "That's correct, Charlie, isn't it?"
"Mrs. Clipstone's a right smart lady," Charlie said.
I could hardly believe what they were saying. It was beginning to look as though just about everybody in the entire district was in on this poaching lark. "The vicar is very fond of roasted pheasant for his dinner," my father said.
"Who isn't?"
Charlie Kinch said, and he started chuckling to himself all over again. We were driving through the village now, and the street lamps were lit, and the men were wandering home from the pubs, all full of beer. I saw Mr. Snoddy, my headmaster, a bit wobbly on his feet, and trying to let himself in secretly through the side door of his house. But what he didn't see was Mrs. Snoddy's sharp, frosty face sticking out of the upstairs window, watching him. "You know something, Danny," my father said. "We've done these birds a great kindness putting them to sleep in this nice, painless way. They'd have had a nasty time of it tomorrow if we hadn't got them first."
"Rotten shots, most of them fellas are," Charlie Kinch said. "At least half the birds finish up winged and wounded."
The taxi turned left and swung in through the gates of the vicarage. There were no lights in the house and nobody met us. My father and I got out and dumped the pheasants in the coal shed at the rear. Then we said goodbye to Charlie Kinch and began to walk the 2 miles back to the filling station.
Chapter 18 Home. Soon we had left the village behind us and were in open country. There was no one else in sight, just the two of us, my father and I, tired but happy, striding out along the curvy country road in the light of the moon.
"I can't believe it," my father kept saying. "I simply cannot believe we pulled it off." "My heart is still thumping," I said. "So is mine. So is mine. But, oh, Danny," he cried, laying a hand on my shoulder, "didn't we have a glorious time?"
We were walking right in the middle of the road, as though it were a private driveway running through our country estate, and we were the lords of all we surveyed. "Do you realize, Danny," my father said, "that on this very night, on this Friday the 30th of September, you and I have actually bagged 120 prime pheasants from Mr. Hazel's wood?" I looked at my father. His face was alight with happiness, and his arms were waving all over the place as he went prancing along the middle of the road with his funny iron foot going clink, clink, clink.
"Roasted pheasant," he cried out, addressing the moon and the entire countryside. "The finest and most succulent dish on earth." "I don't suppose you've ever eaten roasted pheasant, have you, Danny?"
"Never," I said.
"You wait," he cried. "You just wait till you taste it. It has an unbelievable flavor. It's sheer magic."
"Does it have to be roasted, Dad?"
"Of course it has to be roasted. You don't ever boil a young bird."
"Why do you ask that?" "I was wondering how we would do the roasting," I said. "Don't you have to have an oven or something?"
"Of course," he said.
"But we don't have an oven, Dad. All we've got is a paraffin burner."
"I know," he said. "And that is why I have decided to buy an oven."
"Buy one?" I cried.
"Yes, Danny," he said. "With such a great and glorious stock of pheasants on our hands, it is important that we have the proper equipment. Therefore, we shall go back into the village tomorrow morning, and we shall buy an electric oven. We can get one at Wheeler's, and we'll put it in the workshop. We've got plenty of electric plugs in the workshop."
"Won't it be very expensive?"
"No expense is too great for roasted pheasant," my father announced superbly. "And don't forget, Danny, before we put the bird in the oven, we have to lay strips of fat bacon across the breast to keep it nice and juicy. And bread sauce, too. We shall have to make bread sauce. You must never have roasted pheasant without lashings of bread sauce. There are three things you must always have with roasted pheasant: bread sauce, chipped potatoes, and boiled parsnips."
There was half a minute's silence as we both allowed ourselves the pleasure of dreaming about these beautiful foods.
"And I'll tell you what else we've got to get," my father said. "We've got to get one of those deep freezers where you can store things for months and months and they never go rotten."
"Dad," I said, "no."
"But don't you realize, Danny, that even after we've given birds away to all our friends, to Charlie Kinch and the Reverend Clipstone and Doc Spencer and Enoch Samways and all the rest of them, there'll still be about 50 left for us. That is why we are going to need a deep freezer."
"But it'll cost the earth."
"And worth every penny of it," he cried. "Just imagine, Danny, my boy, any time we fancy a nice roasted pheasant for our supper, all we've got to do is open up the lid of the freezer and help ourselves. Kings and queens don't live any better than that."
A barn owl flew across the road in front of us, its great white wings waving slowly in the moonlight. "Did your mum have an oven in the kitchen, Dad?" I asked, "when you were a boy."
"She had something better than an oven," he said. "It was called a cooker. It was a great big long black thing, and we used to stoke it up with coal, and it kept going for 24 hours a day. It never went out. And if we didn't have any coal, we used bits of wood."
"Could you roast pheasants in it?"
"You could roast anything in it, Danny. Oh, it was a lovely thing, that old cooker. It used to keep the whole house warm in the winter."
"But you never had a cooker of your own, did you, Dad? You and Mum, when you got married? Or an oven?"
"No," he said.
We couldn't afford things like that.
Then how did you roast your pheasants?
Ah, he said. That was quite a trick. We used to build a fire outside the caravan and roast them on a spit, the way the gypsies do.
What's a spit? I asked.
It's just a long metal spike, and you stick it through the pheasant and put it over the fire and keep turning it round. What you do is you push two forked sticks into the ground, one on each side of the fire, and you rest the spit on the forks.
Did it roast them well?
Fairly well, he said. But an oven would do it better. Listen, Danny, Mr. Wheeler has all sorts of marvellous ovens in his shop now. He's got one in there with so many dials and knobs on it, it looks like the cockpit of an airplane.
Is that the one you want to buy, Dad?
I don't know, he said. We'll decide tomorrow. We kept walking, and soon we saw the filling station glimmering in the moonlight ahead of us.
Will Mr. Rabbit be waiting for us, do you think, Dad?
If he is, you won't see him, Danny. They always hide and watch you from behind a hedge or a tree, and they only come out if you're carrying a sack over your shoulder, or if your pocket is bulging with something suspicious. We're carrying nothing at all, so don't worry about it. Whether or not Mr. Rabbits was watching us as we entered the filling station and headed for the caravan, I don't know. We saw no sign of him. Inside the caravan, my father lit the paraffin lamp, and I lit the burner, and put the kettle on to make us a cup of cocoa each.
That, my father said as we sat sipping our hot cocoa a few minutes later, was the greatest time I've ever had in my whole life.
Chapter 19 Rockabye Baby. At 8:30 the next morning, my father went into the workshop and dialed Doc Spencer's number on the telephone. "Now listen, Doctor," he said. "If you could be here at the filling station in about half an hour, I think I might have a little surprise present for you." The doctor said something in reply, and my father replaced the receiver. At 9 o'clock, Doc Spencer arrived in his car. My father went over to him, and the two of them held a whispered conversation beside the pumps. Suddenly, the tiny doctor clapped his hands together and sprang up high in the air, hooting with laughter.
"You don't mean it," he cried. "It's not possible."
He then rushed over to me and grasped my hand in his.
"I do congratulate you, my dear boy," he cried,
pumping my hand up and down so fiercely it nearly came off.
"What a triumph! What a miracle! What a victory! Now, why on earth didn't I think of that method myself? You are a genius, sir. Hail to thee, Sir Danny. You're the champion of the world!"
"Here she comes," my father called out, pointing down the road. "Here she comes, Doctor!"
"Here who comes?" the doctor said.
"Mrs. Clipstone."
He spoke the name proudly, as though he were a commander referring to his bravest officer. The three of us stood together beside the pumps, looking down the road.
"Can't you see her?" my father asked.
Far away in the distance, I could just make out a small figure advancing towards us.
"What's she pushing, Dad?"
My father gave me a sly look. "There's only one way of delivering pheasants safely," he said, "and that's under a baby. Isn't that right, Doctor?"
"Under a baby?" Doc Spencer said.
"Of course. In a pram, with the baby on top."
"Fantastic,"
the doctor said. "My old dad thought that one up many years ago," my father said, "and it's never been known to fail yet."
"It's brilliant," Doc Spencer said. "Only a brilliant mind could think of a thing like that."
"He was a brilliant man," my father said. "Can you see her now, Doctor? And that'll be young Christopher Clipstone sitting up in the pram. He's 1 and a half, our lovely child."
"I birthed him," Doc Spencer said. "He weighed 8 pounds, 3 ounces.
I could just make out the small dot of a baby sitting high up in the pram, which had its hood folded down. "There's more than 100 pheasants under that little nipper," my father said happily. "Just imagine it."
"You can't put 100 pheasants in a child's perambulator," Doc Spencer said. "Don't be ridiculous."
"You can, if it's been specially made for the job," my father said. "This one is built extra long and extra wide, and it's got an extra deep well underneath. Listen, you could push a cow around in there if you wanted to, let alone 100 pheasants and a baby."
"Did you make it yourself, Dad?" I asked.
"More or less, Danny. You remember when I walked you to school and then went off to buy the raisins?"
"The day before yesterday," I said.
"Yes. And after that, I went straight on to the vicarage and converted their pram into this special extra-large poacher's model. It's a beauty, really it is. You wait till you see it. And Mrs. Clipstone says it pushes even easier than her ordinary one. She did a practice circuit with it in her backyard as soon as I'd finished it."
"Fantastic,"
the doctor said again.
"Absolutely fantastic."
"Normally," my father went on, "an ordinary bought pram is all you'd ever need. But then, no one's ever had over 100 pheasants to deliver before now."
"Where does the baby sit?"
the doctor asked. "On top, of course," my father said. "All you need is a sheet to cover them, and the baby sits on the sheet. A bunch of pheasants makes a nice soft mattress for any child."
"I don't doubt it," the doctor said.
"He'll be having a very comfortable ride today, young Christopher," my father said. We stood behind the pumps, waiting for Mrs. Clipstone to arrive. It was the 1st of October, and one of those warm, windless autumn mornings with a darkening sky and a smell of thunder in the air. What was so marvellous about my father, I thought, was the way he always surprised you. It was impossible to be with him for long without being surprised and astounded by one thing or another. He was like a conjurer bringing things out of a hat. Right now, it was the pram and the baby. In a few minutes, it would be something else again, I felt sure of that.
"Right through the village, bold as brass," my father said. "Good for her."
"She seems in an awful hurry, Dad," I said. "She's sort of half running. Don't you think she's sort of half running, Dr. Spencer?"
"I imagine she's just a bit anxious to unload her cargo," the doctor said.
My father squinted down the road at the approaching figure.
"She does appear to be going a bit quick, doesn't she?" he said carefully.
"She's going very quick," I said. There was a pause. My father was beginning to stare hard at the lady in the distance.
"Perhaps she doesn't want to be caught in the rain," he said. "I'll bet that's exactly what it is. She thinks it's going to rain, and she doesn't want the baby to get wet."
"She could put the hood up," I said. He didn't answer this.
"She's running," Doc Spencer cried. "Look!"
It was true. Mrs. Clipstone had suddenly broken into a full sprint. My father stood very still, staring at her. And in the silence that followed, I fancied I could hear a baby screaming.
"What's up, Dad?"
He didn't reply.
"There's something wrong with that baby," Doc Spencer said. "Listen."
At this point, Mrs. Clipstone was about 200 yards away from us, but closing fast.
"Can you hear him now, Dad?"
"Yes, I can hear him."
"He's yelling his head off," Doc Spencer said.
The small, shrill voice in the distance was growing louder every second, frantic, piercing, non-stop.
"He's having a fit," my father said.
"It's a good thing we've got a doctor handy." Doc Spencer didn't say anything. "That's why she's running, doctor," my father said. "He's having a fit, and she wants to get him in here quick and put him under a cold tap."
"Some noise," I said.
"If it isn't a fit," my father said, "you can bet your life it's something like it."
"I doubt it's a fit,"
the doctor said. My father shifted his feet uneasily on the gravel of the driveway. "There's 1,001 different things keep happening every day to little babies like that," he said. "That's right, isn't it, doctor?"
"Of course,"
Doc Spencer said.
"Every day."
"I knew a baby once who caught his fingers in the spokes of a pram wheel," my father said. "It cut them clean off." The doctor smiled.
Whatever it is, my father said. I wish to heaven she'd stop running.
It'll give the game away.
A long lorry loaded with bricks came up behind the pram, and the driver slowed down and poked his head out of the window to stare. Mrs. Clipstone ignored him and flew on. She was so close now, I could see her big red face with the mouth wide open, panting for breath. I noticed she was wearing white gloves on her hands, very prim and dainty. And there was a funny little white hat to match, perched right on top of her head, like a mushroom. Suddenly, out of the pram, straight up into the air, flew an enormous pheasant. My father let out a cry of horror. The fool in the lorry began roaring with laughter. The pheasant flapped around drunkenly for a few seconds, then lost height and landed on the grass by the side of the road.
"Crikey!"
Doc Spencer said.
"Look at that!"
A grocer's van came up behind the lorry and began hooting to get by. Mrs. Clipstone kept on running. Then, whoosh, a second pheasant flew up out of the pram. Then a third and a fourth.
"Great Scott!" Doc Spencer said. "I know what's happened. It's the sleeping pills. They're wearing off."
My father didn't say a word. Mrs. Clipstone covered the last 50 yards at a tremendous pace. She came swinging into the filling station with birds flying out of the pram in all directions.
"What on earth is happening?" she shrieked.
She pulled up sharp against the first pump and seized the screaming infant in her arms and dragged him clear. With the weight of the child suddenly lifted away, a great cloud of pheasants rose up out of the gigantic pram. There must have been well over 100 of them, and the whole sky above us was filled with huge brown birds clapping their wings.
"A sleeping pill doesn't last forever," Doc Spencer said, shaking his head sadly. "It always wears off by the next morning."
The pheasants were too dopey to fly far. In a few seconds down they came again and settled themselves like a swarm of locusts all over the filling station. The place was covered with them. They sat wing to wing along the roof of the workshop, and about a dozen were clinging to the sill of the office window. Some had flown down onto the rack that held the bottles of lubricating oil, and others were sliding about on the bonnet of Doc Spencer's car. One cockbird with a fine tail was perched superbly on top of a petrol pump, and quite a number, those that were too drunk to do anything else, simply squatted in the driveway at our feet, fluffing their feathers and blinking their small eyes. My father stayed remarkably calm, but not poor Mrs. Clipstone.
"They nearly pecked him to pieces,"
she was crying, clasping the screaming baby to her bosom.
"Take him into the caravan, Mrs. Clipstone," my father said. "All these birds are making him nervous. And Danny, push that pram into the workshop, quick."
Mrs. Clipstone disappeared into our caravan with the baby. I pushed the pram into the workshop. Across the road, a line of cars had already started forming behind the brick lorry and the grocery van. People were opening their doors and getting out and beginning to cross over to stare at the pheasants.
"Watch out, Dad," I said. "Look who's here."
Chapter 20. Goodbye, Mr. Hazel. The big shiny silver Rolls-Royce had braked suddenly and come to a stop right alongside the filling station. Behind the wheel, I could see the enormous, pink, beery face of Mr. Victor Hazel staring at the pheasants. I could see the mouth hanging open, the eyes bulging out of his head like toadstools, and the skin of his face turning from pink to bright scarlet. The car door opened, and out he came, resplendent in fawn-coloured riding breeches and high-polished boots. There was a yellow silk scarf with red dots on it round his neck, and he had a sort of bowler hat on his head. The great shooting party was about to begin, and he was on his way to greet the guests. He left the door of the Rolls open and came at us like a charging bull. My father, Doc Spencer, and I stood close together in a little group, waiting for him. He started shouting at us the moment he got out of the car, and he went on shouting for a long time after that. I am sure you would like to know what he said, but I cannot possibly repeat it here. The language he used was so foul and filthy it scorched my ear holes. Words came out of his mouth that I had never heard before and hope never to hear again. Little flecks of white foam began forming around his lips and running down his chin onto the yellow silk scarf. I glanced at my father. He was standing very still and very calm, waiting for the shouting to finish. The colour was back in his cheeks now, and I could see the tiny twinkling wrinkles of a smile around the corners of his eyes. Doc Spencer stood beside him, and he was also very calm. He was looking at Mr. Hazel, rather as one would look at a slug on a leaf of lettuce in the salad. I myself did not feel quite so calm.
"But they are not your pheasants," my father said at last. "They're mine."
"Don't lie to me, man!" yelled Mr. Hazel. "I'm the only person round here who has pheasants!"
"They are on my land," my father said quietly. "They flew onto my land, and so long as they stay on my land, they belong to me. Don't you know the rules, you bloated old blue-faced baboon?"
Doc Spencer started to giggle. Mr. Hazel's skin turned from scarlet to purple. His eyes and his cheeks were bulging so much with rage, it looked as though someone was blowing up his face with a pump. He glared at my father. Then he glared at the dopey pheasants swarming all over the filling station.
"What's the matter with them?" he shouted. "What have you done to them?"
At this point, pedalling grandly towards us on his black bicycle, came the arm of the law in the shape of Sergeant Enoch Samways, resplendent in his blue uniform and shiny silver buttons. It was always a mystery to me how Sergeant Samways could sniff out trouble wherever it was. Let there be a few boys fighting on the pavement, or two motorists arguing over a dented bumper, and you could bet your life the village policeman would be there within minutes. We all saw him coming now, and a little hush fell upon the entire company. I imagine the same sort of thing happens when a king or a president enters a room full of chattering people. They all stop talking and stand very still as a mark of respect for a powerful and important person. Sergeant Samways dismounted from his bicycle and threaded his way carefully through the mass of pheasants squatting on the ground. The face behind the big black moustache showed no surprise, no anger, no emotion of any kind. It was calm and neutral, as the face of the law should always be. For a full half minute, he allowed his eyes to travel slowly round the filling station, gazing at the mass of pheasants squatting all over the place. The rest of us, including even Mr. Hazel, waited in silence for judgment to be pronounced.
"Well, well, well," said Sergeant Samways at last,
puffing out his chest and addressing nobody in particular.
"What, may I ask, is happening around here?"
Sergeant Samways had a funny habit of sometimes putting the letter H in front of words that shouldn't have an H there at all. And as though to balance things out, he would take away the H from all the words that should have begun with that letter.
"I'll tell you what's happening round here," shouted Mr. Hazel,
advancing upon the policeman.
"These are my pheasants, and this rogue,"
pointing at my father,
"has enticed them out of my woods onto his filthy little filling station."
"Henticed?"
said Sergeant Samways, looking first at Mr. Hazel, then at us.
"Henticed them, did you say?"
"Of course he enticed them."
"Well now,"
said the sergeant, propping his bicycle carefully against one of our pumps.
"This is a very interesting accusation. Very interesting indeed, because I ain't never heard of nobody enticing a pheasant across 6 miles of fields and open countryside. How do you think this enticing was performed, Mr. Hazel, if I may ask?"
"Don't ask me how he did it, because I don't know," shouted Mr. Hazel. "But he's done it all right. The proof is all around you. All my finest birds are sitting here in this dirty little filling station when they ought to be off in my own wood, getting ready for the shoot."
The words poured out of Mr. Hazel's mouth like hot lava from an erupting volcano.
"Am I correct?" said Sergeant Samways. "Am I absolutely accurate in thinking that today